Hi everyone, this is Grant at Cause Artist. In episode 206 of the Disruptors for Good podcast, I speak with Michael Sheldrick, co-founder of Global Citizen, on dedicating his life to driving systemic policy changes to combat extreme poverty worldwide. In this episode, he shares his insights into the work of Global Citizen, his experiences, and his new book, From Ideas to Impact, a playbook for influencing and implementing change in a divided world. Over the past decade, Global Citizen has mobilized millions of individuals worldwide to take action on critical issues such as climate change, poverty, and inequality. Michael has worked on campaigns globally with artists including Beyoncé, Coldplay, Idris, and Sabrina Elba, Lady Gaga, Miley Cyrus, Rihanna, Usher, and world leaders including Belgian Prime Minister Alexander De Croo, Norwegian Prime Minister Erna Solberg, South African President Cyril Ramaphosa, former UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, and former Australian Prime Ministers Julia Gillard and Kevin Rudd. Through these collaborative efforts with governments, businesses, foundations, and the artist community, Global Citizen has distributed over $40 billion to anti-poverty initiatives, making significant strides towards achieving its mission. I hope you enjoy the conversation. Until next time, stay humble and stay creative.
Well, thank you so much, Michael, for joining me today. You know, very excited to talk about your incredible journey, sort of the journey of Global Citizen, what you and the team have built. Before we kind of get into your journey, the genesis of Global Citizen, I guess talk a little bit about the mission and vision of Global Citizen. For those who don't know, there's a lot of tentacles to it. It's pretty massive in scope. So I guess try to just narrow it down into when somebody asks you, you know, what Global Citizen is, how do you narrow it down for them?
Yeah, look, it's funny. I remember years ago on a flight and someone overhearing a conversation just before I was due to take off. And the person turned to me afterwards and said, are you like the James Bond for solving poverty or something? So I hear you when people say, well, what is Global Citizen? Because the other flip side, I'm here in New York and everyone in New York knows us for primarily one thing, and that's the Global Citizen Festival, right?
Yep.
Which takes place every year on the Great Lawn of Central Park. We've just announced our dates for this year, literally an hour ago, by the way. So if anyone's interested, you'll be able to come along later this year. But beyond all of that, you know, what Global Citizen is, you know, it's a platform, and it's a platform for people to take action to contribute to ending extreme poverty. And so we say our true north is a world without extreme poverty, and we say action taken is our currency. And so if you take the festival as one example, no one really buys tickets. They take action, they volunteer their time, and in doing so, they can trade in those actions for points, and they can then redeem those points for the chance to earn tickets and other cool rewards as well. But I think, you know, at the heart of the movement that we've helped catalyze and create, and, you know, is really done in partnership with so many phenomenal partners around the world. You know, at the crux is really this idea of pop meets policy. And what that means is we leverage the power of popular culture to mainstream these issues and to give people a way to take action. And, you know, we say that we care about impact over ideology, and we're not interested in just raising awareness about problems. And so this movement and this platform for citizens to take action has helped lead to more than 30 million citizen actions. And when I say actions, that can be anything such as a petition, a tweet, an email or a phone call to, say, your local elected official. Mm-hmm. And in partnership with, you know, some incredible organizations, that's helped unlock $40 billion,
great,
which has been dispersed directly to organizations doing tremendous work that our impact team estimates has helped reach the lives of some 1 billion people. And I should clarify, none of that money, that $40 billion, comes to Global Citizen.
Mm-hmm.
We're fortunate to have some incredible philanthropic corporate partners and many others that support our work, but it means all of the commitments you see announced in response to our campaign, all of that goes directly to incredible organizations doing the work around the world.
You mentioned looking at popular culture and trying to align with that to, you know, deliver a message to, you know, maybe showcase some issues, some hard issues to talk about, you know, without having, you know, somebody in popular culture to kind of, you know, get people in the door, let's say, to maybe listen to music or see an artist or something, but also, you know, hear a message that they might not hear every day, right? They kind of going to when the organization was founded, was that always sort of the idea for Global Citizen was, hey, from day one, we want to build something that aligns, like we have to get people to take these actions. And how do we do that, right? Was it always looking at popular culture, looking at artists, looking at the people who resonate with young people and aligning with them? Was that always sort of the core strategy from the beginning?
You know, I would answer that in two ways. The first is the fact that when we started, and I'm obviously one of the co-founders, and there's several others as well, but we were student activists. And like many that want to do good, we started, to be honest, purely trying to raise lots of money and put that money directly into funded programs like building schools. So I went around my local shopping center, the very first campaign I did, asked for all these free cool rewards. It could have been anything, like a free McDonald's voucher or something. Did a quiz night at my old high school. We raised $1,000 and we went and built a school in Papua New Guinea, or contributed to those efforts that were going towards school construction. Then in my summer and winter breaks at university, I traveled to India, Bangladesh, Timor-Leste, and Papua New Guinea. And, you know, it was, on the one hand, you'd see the impact of these funds raised, but also you'd look around and you'd be like, wow, there's a lot of poverty. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of kids that don't have access to education. And, you know, you had to ask yourself the question, how many charity quiz nights is it going to take to end extreme poverty? And the reality is no amount of gala night charity dinners is going to raise the billions of dollars needed to end extreme poverty, because systemic challenges like poverty or climate change require systemic solutions. And if you look throughout history, how these solutions have often been galvanized, it's come about through social movements, right? You look at the US civil rights movement, you look at how apartheid was ended in South Africa. And so that's really where Global Citizen came about, was the idea that, okay, we need to galvanize people, we need to galvanize the public. And from that, we got involved, you know, at using the power of social media. When we first started, it was quite nascent at the time. It was, you know, still in the early Facebook days. We got involved with asking local musicians in Australia to lend their voice, to amplify it. And we found that actually this was a great platform to give people a way to take action. And I would say this is grounded in the theory, you know, when it comes to promoting policy change, there's this theory that some of the folks use called the Overton window. And the Overton window basically says, okay, all of the policies that are acceptable to society, that's in the Overton window, right? So if it's not in the Overton window, it's either deemed too radical or it's not acceptable, and politicians won't follow. And so our goal was, how can we make sure that the policies needed to end extreme poverty are in the Overton window, right? And in many cases, that includes persuading public opinion. And, you know, I could see this throughout history. You know, these days, things like Live Aid in the UK, right? Yeah. You remember the 80s and you remember Queen's epic performance and Bono or U2. These days, a lot of those efforts get panned because, you know, they're seen as paternalistic and patriarchal, all of those things, right? And you know, the framing's changed. But one thing that was a consequence, particularly in the UK, of those efforts is you had a whole generation of young people growing up in Britain in the 90s and in the early 2000s that basically remembered that. Remembered the power of music and also felt that they had a responsibility to contribute more. And when many of those people who were young in the 80s, you call them the Live Aid generation, when they got into power, like people like David Cameron, they actually translated that interest into public policy. And like the UK for a decade was the most generous nation out of, you know, the wealthiest countries in the world. And it could be traced back to that. And so the power of popular culture can have a tremendous impact, you know, in terms of shaping policy. And I guess my parents had been, they were classic British expats. They had grown up in the UK, come to Australia before they had me, but they would often talk about that legacy of Live Aid, and they would talk about the power of music. And there's many other examples as well, like George Harrison and the concert for Bangladesh at Madison Square Garden. And I think for us, when we were starting Global Citizen, it was asking ourselves, what's the next iteration of that?
Yep.
And the next iteration was basically this idea of getting people to take action rather than just buying tickets and using that action to generate multi-billion dollar commitments in response to the campaigns.
You mentioned, you know, the word extreme poverty quite a few times. How does the organization define that? I mean, just do you look at the UN's description of extreme poverty and kind of start there and then look at places of the world that where it's most prevalent? And is that sort of where you kind of aim some of the strategies or ideas? I guess talk through just, you know, extreme poverty in general. It kind of changes with, you know, GDP, I guess, up and down around the world. Some, you know, India's having a great rise right now, but there's, you know, historically they've had some very poor areas and, you know, East Asia and Latin America. I mean, there's extreme poverty in certain parts of the world can feel different, I guess, or be defined different. I guess, how does the organization, you know, how do you look at it? How do they define it?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. Many campaigns, you know, often resort to raising awareness around a problem because they're not carried by a very clearly defined goal. And we used SMART criteria, Global Citizen. So is it specific? Is it measurable? Is it achievable? Is it relevant? Is it time bound? And so that applies to our broad mission, our True North, to end extreme poverty as the kind of anchor. And so to answer your question directly, you know, extreme poverty currently is measured by those who live under $1.90 a day. You know, and to your point, it's been up until, I think, 2019, 2020, the story of the 30 years prior to that had been the story of great progress. You had an unprecedented number of people being lifted out of extreme poverty in a very short time. And it was, you know, in many cases, the greatest success story in the history of humanity. And some of that you could argue was due to trade and mm-hmm. you know, China's rise. You could look at India, but it was also because governments were putting a lot of money into health and education as well, right? Because alongside the reduction of people living in poverty, you also had a massive reduction of children dying before the age of five. Yeah. And that was phenomenal because at the same time, you also had the explosion in population growth, right? Mm-hmm. So the fact you could have that alongside each other was, again, unprecedented. When you look at even going back 200 years ago, if you were a kid born in the UK or in America 200 years ago, or you were a mother going into childbirth, there was a reasonable chance you might die and not make it through childbirth. I think,
you know,
well, there's that statistic about the Mayflower that I forget the exact number, but there was something like, people can look up the exact statistic themselves, but it was something like of the original, I think, I want to say 13 women that came on the Mayflower, something like all but two had died in the first 12 months because of childbirth, you know, and people can look up the exact statistic. But I guess, you know, from our point of view, everything comes back to this goal, right? And what you had is in 2019, 2020, the world was making progress. We got the number of people living in extreme poverty down to just 700 million. And then, of course, in the last 4 or 5 years since then, you've had this reversal of progress. And that's been due to a number of factors. First and foremost, it was the pandemic and it was the economic consequences in large part that came because of the pandemic that for the first time saw the number of people living in extreme poverty rise. Mm-hmm. Then since that, you've had the war in Ukraine, the impact on food prices, on fertilizer prices, that had a huge role to play as well. And so you've seen, you know, this reversal and numbers begin to rise in many parts of the world. And so for us as an organization, and again, you bring it back to the principle in our book, the challenge is how do we stay laser tight focused? Because in this day and age, it's easy to get dragged everywhere to every cause under the sun. And so we have to, whenever we get requests for support, we have to apply a filter and say, well, how does this ladder up? Because there was a great quote by the Prime Minister of Barbados, who I heard address the UN last year, and she said, simplicity is how we get to the end. as soon as we stand for everything and we try and, you know, have a grab bag of everything under the sun, we've lost the game. And this is often a fatal flaw that I see in many, many campaign efforts, as they try to bite off more than they can chew rather than being focused.
Yeah. I don't know about how to measure success, but like, what has worked? You know, like you said, dealing with extreme poverty, there's so many organizations that you probably work with. There's people on government levels. It's like, hey, how do we allocate the money properly? I guess from, you know, the many countries that the organization has worked in, the many projects that you've been a part of, and the many organizations that, you know, you've probably talked to about, you know, what they need and what their strategies are on the ground. What did you see that has worked? And, you know, now that we're a bit out of the pandemic, can those same strategies sort of still work and kind of bring those numbers, you know, back down pre-pandemic, where we were seeing extreme poverty, you know, slowly but surely being ended in how it's defined?
Again, it's a great, loving these questions. You know, I would say what's worked fundamentally is following the money, right? And what I mean by that, and this is why I call my book Ideas to Impact and Focus on Implementation. And implementation is not a sexy word, and it's something that seems very abstract and vague. But by following the money, making sure that when politicians make promises, that the dollars they actually pledge are new specific, and that those dollars actually get to where they're meant to, is fundamental. And, you know, if we look at the period leading up to 2019, you know, the 2 decades going into that, we actually saw that, you know, yes, there was a little bit of politicians getting together and, you know, having a nice lunch, saying a lot of nice words, going out, clapping themselves on the back, and then forgetting about those promises. But we also saw significant money being transferred to incredible organizations. If you look in America, the largest upsurge in American development assistance actually occurred under the Bush administration. And for instance, you know, over the 20-year period, from 2003, I think it was, until 2023, you know, they put billions of dollars, which is a very small fraction of the overall U.S. budget, into, I think, saving something like 20 million lives.
Yeah.
People's lives through access to antiretroviral drugs, access to technologies that have been developed in the 90s, so that, for instance, the AIDS epidemic, which in the 90s, you know, was one of the biggest scourges across parts of Africa, you know, meant that if you were contracted HIV/AIDS, it was in many cases a death sentence, that those medical treatments were made available was in large part because of that aid. And the reason why you had that commitment, the reason why you had dollars flow, like, as much as you can talk about, was it because of the commitment and faith of leaders? It was because you also had this very active and thriving civil society, right? In America, you had this whole movement. Bono talks about it as being everything from church leaders to faith groups, you know, to soccer moms, where if a politician reneged on their promise, they knew that they were going to hear about it, right? So you kind of had these coalitions. And a big part of that was also popular culture as well. Popular culture and, you know, musicians standing up and actually applauding leaders for their contribution. And these ending extreme poverty, you know, throughout that period, it transcended the left-right paradigm. It wasn't a matter of politics, you know.
I can't imagine it happening today where...
In my business, you gotta remain an optimist. And I can see it in two ways. But first, just going back to your point, I also think people saw votes on it. I mean, let's be clear. Fair. People do things for the self-interest. And I think when you had George W. Bush, who was incredibly unpopular because of the war in Iraq, when someone like Bono was willing to praise him and publicly, and I think Bono famously said he could kiss George Bush bring those votes. I think there was a sense, hey, look, you know, this is something I can do because it's going to make me popular both abroad, but also at home. But putting that all to one side, the reason why I'm optimistic is you can certainly see one side of the coin and say, you know, has the movement to end extreme poverty, is it at risk of getting caught in the crosshairs of polarization, right? Like many other issues out there. And and that coalition, that sustained investment in these issues for so long, right, has that all been undermined, right? And is that a fact that we are seeing playing out right now? So certainly there is that argument. But on the flip side of that, when you look at where public opinion is, even in America, you know, I was part of this study last year called the Global Solidarity Report. And what it showed is people, the public, still overwhelmingly, including in America, backed investments in ending extreme poverty because they recognized that's in our self-interest. More than 50% of the world still identified as global citizens.
I think travel helps so tremendously now because we get to interact with different parts of the world, right? I mean, people travel at a younger age now. There's, you know, trips you can take. I mean, the cost of travel is, while it's expensive, I mean, it's a bit relative. You can get places, you know, if you want, fairly cheaply, kind of depending, but there's all kind of organizations you can go with. And there's just a lot of opportunity to travel and see parts of the world. And I think, obviously, once you do that, you connect, right, and on a human level. And so when, you know, earthquakes happen around the world or hurricanes and whatever it might be, whatever sort of tragedy that the world faces, there is a connection, I think. And we kind of see it all the time when we see the images. We see this uptick in donations, whether it's Red Cross or something like that, when something pretty horrific happens and there's imagery of it. There is sort of still this human connection that understands the pain that, you know, a mother goes through, and, you know, those tears of a mother or a father, like, that's just, there's a connection there that just, that will always be there, you know, no matter what it is. And I say that because I want to talk a little bit about how technology can enable this next sort of, let's say generation of trying to solve extreme poverty in a different way. Because no matter where you go, people have phones. It's like the most incredible thing ever. Doesn't matter if you live in, you know, a tin shed with no electricity, no running water, there's going to be a member of the family that has a phone, if not everybody in the family has a phone. And so there's activations on a lot of different levels, I guess, that hasn't necessarily been there before. But how has the organization maybe leveraged technology? How have you seen it grow ever since the, you know, the organization started? I guess, how have you, you know, embedded tech throughout the entire platform? And how has it been an advantage? How have you seen that play? Perhaps a positive, and maybe there's negative roles that it does play as well.
Yeah, and first of all, I loved what you were saying as well about how we've evolved, and maybe somewhere in our subconsciousness has evolved because of the power of connectivity. And I often say maybe that was one of the positive aspects of globalization. We tend to look back on the economic, the job displacement component. But when you look at that connectivity, maybe that's why we do have a degree of solidarity and why there were groups in America that was outraged, going back to what I was saying before about the inequities in the world, which is something we didn't have 100 years ago. And I also wonder if the reason why there's also in certain parts of the world, you know, still, you know, a sense of connection or a sense of, you know, really identifying as global citizenship. And this is a good segue to your point on technology. When I was looking at the survey data of where people identified most as global citizens, it was in emerging economies, right? So in particular, I think Nigeria was number one. And obviously, Nigeria is one of the fastest growing nations in the world in terms of their population. I think they're on track to overtake China and have over 1 billion people. And by the end of the century, will be the second populous country in the world. You look at India, which India also scored highly. And I asked around, you know, for analysis on why the data was showing, you know, that young people in these countries, which make up large numbers, identify as global citizens. And someone said, well, literally, you know, we in our own lives, we've seen the pace of technology. Like when you and I were kids, I'm sure when we reflect on certain things, we're like, wow, yeah, we've got access. but it probably didn't really transform our access to basic needs, right? Like it's made our world more efficient. Whereas if you were born, if you're someone who's the same age as us in, say, India, and you reflect back on the last 3 to 4 decades, then you've really seen technology have a material impact on your life, improving it and improving your access to basic needs. Even what you were saying on everyone having a cell phone, being able to bank, being able to store, being able to earn an income, being able to therefore take out loans, something as fundamental as that, which we all take for granted and our parents had access to. So I think that when you've seen the positive impact of technology and that transformative impact, you can definitely see how that correlates to people, okay, identifying as global citizen. Why as global citizen? Because they relate that expansion in technology with the world around them and how it's through, say, globalization that technology has been available. But I think coming back to your question of how we incorporate it at Global Citizen, yeah, I think the answer is twofold. Obviously, you know, we incorporate it into our own platform, right? So in terms of people taking action, how we can improve it, how we can make the platform more accessible and how we can reach people where they're at. You know, very early on, we recognized that not everyone, for instance, we've got quite a big following in certain parts of Africa. We recognize, you know, not everyone can afford the data to download a big app, right?
Yeah.
So how did we use, you know, Facebook Messenger or WhatsApp and, you know, automated bots to give people a way to take action and still contribute and engage in the movement? And so I think for us, it's how have we used technology, you know, actually as to increase the accessibility of people being able to use their voice and to take action. Right. That's been a huge driver of our work and a huge focus of say our product and technology teams. I think the other way where technology has played a clear role is also in the work we do to end extreme poverty and the policies we pursue. Because, you know, on the one hand, yes, more people have mobile phones. But you still have this division where one in three people don't have reliable access to the internet, right?
Yeah.
So a lot of the tools we're talking about, how do we access them? And I think something like more than 600 million people across sub-Saharan Africa still don't have reliable access to energy. They live in energy poverty, basically.
Yeah.
And so how can we overcome that so everyone can leverage the full power of these new technology tools? So I see it in both. It's like, how on the one hand do we campaign so that these tools are available? And then how can we use these tools to give people a greater say in their democracy and in world institutions or decisions that impact them and calling for meaningful policies that's going to end extreme poverty. Just one example, I mean, we have this huge global town hall we host every year. We bring together 20,000 people, predominantly from Southeast Asia, Indonesia, where through through India. And I can tell you, like, you know, the stuff we're able to do, the connectivity, the engagement, something we wouldn't have been able to do like even 15 years ago, but it's so vibrant and people are yearning out to express themselves and have their voice heard. Like it's incredible. And so, you know, one of the things I've been talking to a lot of people about these days is in what ways can we leverage this technology? And I pose this question at the end of the book, you know, in what ways can we leverage this technology to also disrupt global governance, right? Because people look at the United Nations, they look at all of these big institutions and they say, well, where is our voice in that?
Yeah.
And could you truly have like a global citizens assembly powered by this technology? You know, I think, and there's movements underway on how you could disrupt that. And there's some great organizations that's working towards this, but that's where I think there could be a powerful role. And my sense is, you know, if you build this from the ground up, because trying to get agreement on governments, a lot of people might be afraid of this, but if you could build this from the ground up, you know, and then get others to give it legitimacy, that's where the power might be. But there's a lot of interesting work being done on could we actually come up with more direct participatory forms of governance, really.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the book. I'm always jealous of people who have successfully like actually just done it and then it released it. Like, that is, I'm always jealous of that. Talk about the book, what it's about, and maybe more specifically, like why write it? Why this moment in time to kind of do it?
I can definitely relate to what you've said. Just to comment on the process of writing it. The best deadline I had is, the book publisher approached me and said, we see a niche in, what students are being taught. There could be, you've got something interesting to say. And then, we agreed a deadline. And then shortly after that, we found out that my wife was pregnant with our first child. So there was nothing like having the deadline being the looming birth of our daughter, because I knew if I didn't get the book done, to your point, another year would go by.
Yeah.
And so it was very stressful. I think I wrote most of it in 6 months. I wrote it a lot on my iPhone. Talk about technology. I wrote a lot of it on Google Docs on my iPhone.
Wow.
On planes, on boats, on the New York subway, as you do. So, that was one thing. And then, of course, this is why I'm grateful to folks like you for giving the platform. You realize that, okay, the marketing is really down to you to get the word out. But but look, the reason why I wrote the book is because, I'm incredibly proud of what we've built at Global Citizen. And, I think we've made a huge contribution to ending extreme poverty. And I will often get messages on social media, on Instagram, on LinkedIn, from, in some cases, high school students, university students, everyday citizens, sometimes even maybe elected officials of communities, maybe that vulnerable to climate change or otherwise marginalized. And they're all asking for help or advice to launch their own campaigns. And it might not be on ending extreme poverty. It could be on regulating the challenges of artificial intelligence or combating the impact of climate change. And I didn't want people to feel that they had to go out and replicate what we've done at Global Citizen and establish a big organization, bring together 12 million members. I mean, you can do that. And I talk in the book about how you can establish an advocacy organization. But I also wanted people to feel empowered and not intimidated. And so the book was really my attempt, based on everything I've learned over the last decade and a half at Global Citizen, but more importantly, from the great campaigners and what I call policy entrepreneurs I've seen in action. And it was my attempt to distill 8 principles to give people a start. And my thesis is whether you're a cultural icon like Taylor Swift or a business executive or an everyday citizen, there's something we can all contribute to bring about the systemic change our world needs right now. And so in that respect, the book doesn't profess to have all the answers, but it almost lays out, the hardest part when you're launching a campaign is knowing where to start. Because once you start and you can get some action and you start to see the response, the forward momentum from that will trigger a reaction, you get more support, your friends and families will see it. So really, it's a book to give people, a place to begin in launching their campaigns. Because one of my favorite quotes, and I have this on my fridge, was from Eleanor Roosevelt, who was the first U.S. ambassador to the UN, and she co-wrote the Universal Declaration on Human Rights. She has this wonderful saying, "The best way to begin is to begin." And so that's really the premise of the book.
It's a beautiful thing, man. I kind of will end a little bit, just, as I normally do, talk a little bit, about the future. And, obviously you and the team have accomplished so much and continuing, to do so. There's always going to be, new artists to work with and new organizations or new strategies and new projects to work on. But what does the future look like? If you look at, 3 to 5 years down the line, what do you and the leadership team kind of talk about as you look out on the future? Like, I guess, what are some of those conversations you guys have about that 3 to 5 year timeline?
I think it's, we were essentially a startup when we started, a social enterprise, now 12 million members. And I think we're constantly, aware that in the same way we disrupted social change or provided an evolution on, even the charity, the benefit charity concert model, right? But how to elevate issues on political agendas and bring change, others might come in and disrupt us. And so for us, it's about that constant innovation for how we can keep these issues, which are still around, you know, on the agenda, and showcase people that we still have the opportunity. We are off track. We've gone a little bit backwards over the last few years, but we still have the opportunity to end extreme poverty. And so I think for us, you know, the most powerful thing you can do when you're building a platform is to figure out how to reach your audiences and engage them. And part of the reason why we started with popular culture is because we recognized that it's probably only a small percentage of people that are willing to become, if you like, Mother Teresa, right? And say, I'm going to dedicate my life to this issue. Most of us, you know, want to have a whole range of interests. You have your family, you have your personal interests, and then they look for ways in which they can make a difference as well. And if that making a difference can be intertwined with one of those other interests, then all the better, right? That's going to sustain people's engagement. So the challenge for us is beyond music, right, and popular culture, and that's still got to be part of it, is how, what other methods? Is it in gaming? I mean, there's so many new platforms now and new interests that have spiraled out, but how can we meet people where they're at and give them a way to take action on the critical issues of our time? The other evolution I would say is for years, we saw popular culture itself, you know, as a means or a lever to mainstream these issues, right, and get people to take action. But we didn't really look at the creative industry. And when I say creative industry, I'm talking about arts, culture, music.
Yep.
We didn't really see that whole industry itself as a means to alleviate poverty, provide jobs, and contribute to economic growth and development. And so last year, we launched a five-year strategy in Africa called Move Africa. Mm-hmm. And the goal is to create Africa's first ever music tour that will be sustainable, long lasting. We had the first, we partnered with PG Lang and Kendrick Lamar to build this out. The very first one took place in Kigali, Rwanda. We just announced a few months ago that Ghana will be part of it as well. And we're hopefully announcing the third city for this year in the next few weeks. Our goal is to have five cities by the end of next year. And in this case, we're happy to be disrupted. In this case, the best mark of success would be in 10 years' time if other music acts on the continent and some of the biggest tours in the world are taking place through Africa. And even more so if you can translate that into jobs created, you know, young entrepreneurs creating businesses around it, whether that's in ticketing, whether that's in production. Because, you know, I feel like there's so much potential here. In Nigeria, I met the arts and culture minister earlier this year, and she told me that her president had given her a KPI basically by 2030 to have, I think it was something like something insane, like 20% of their economy coming from the creative industries, you know, growth. And if their economy reaches $1 trillion, which is their plan, that's $200 billion that's been generated. And so I think for us, you know, that's also the goal, is how can we lean into our strengths, you know, whether that's event production, you know, we're known for doing these big events, and actually say, well, look, this is not just part of spreading the word and being a catalyst for policy change. This itself contributes to economic development as well. So I think that's hugely excited. And I'd say the final thing, and this is where the book comes in, is, you know, that I'm excited about, and it's called From Ideas to Impact, a playbook for influencing and implementing change in a divided world. But it's really about if other, you know, so-called policy entrepreneurs are out there, if they're launching their own campaign and we can be helpful, you know, in that case, because we need more people involved in the policymaking process. Government alone cannot solve this. We've seen that. We need others involved around the world. The time for action is now. And because of the advances in technology and science that you and I have been talking about, we actually, more of us have the means to participate than ever before. And, you know, my last appeal to people is, you know, there's so many ways we can make a difference. Yes, we can volunteer our time. We can go out and say plant trees. We can register to vote in the US. Yep. If you're eligible, you can use your voice. You can also donate to charity. But we can also all contribute to change in policy for good as well. It doesn't often service to mind. People don't think, oh, I might go out and change policy, whether that's at a local, state, or national level. But yeah. if you look at the pandemic, right, and you look at the impact the pandemic had on climate change, on the one hand, you know, when we were all locked in our homes because of those lockdown policies, yeah, the air got clean. But, you know, emissions are only reduced by 5 to 6% globally, right? And on the one hand, you can say, wow, that's a lot. On the other hand, you can say, wow, just look at how little our personal actions and personal behavior changes actually contribute in the grand scheme of things. And that's why we've also got to support these huge policy changes so that we can shift our economic systems as well. And that's where we can all contribute to. And change can happen at a local level. It can happen in the business community as well if we're to address some of the biggest issues of our time.
Man, thank you so much, Michael. This was an awesome conversation. Amazing what you and the team have done and built and creatively thinking about ways to activate people. You know, it's a really difficult thing to do. So, you know, congrats again on the success and best of luck for the book and best of luck for the organization for the next decade, my man.
Thank you so much. Really, really appreciate it. And by the way, just to correct my stat earlier, 72% of the women who came across on the Mayflower,
72.
Died by the first winter because of childbirth or other complications. So, you know, just if you wanted a little bit of small dose of optimism, that also is a marker of how far we've come. So just to finish on that optimistic note.
Love it.